This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
For the past three seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a fourth season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. One of the policy positions that Donald Trump is advocating for is the elimination of the Federal Department of Education. And we wanted an opportunity to talk about that proposition, both the upside and the downside. And joining us is J. Celeste Lay, professor of Department of Political Science at Tulane University. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks. You can call me Celeste.
Celeste, excuse me. I'm sorry. I apologize. Right. So, Celeste, kind of an interesting proposition. You don't hear very often about the elimination of a department at the federal level, albeit this department is not nearly as big as most others, about $238 billion in their budget. And about $175 billion of that amount is federal student aid. Your thoughts right. about what it is that this federal department actually does for states across the nation.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. Like you said, it's not the Department of Education is not as big as, say, the Department of Defense, you know, which has a nearly $2 trillion budget. And it's one of the newer departments created by President Carter in the late 70s. But in terms of what it does, like you said, one of its biggest programs or its biggest program is federal student loans for college. And then beyond the funding of college, one of the things that it funds is K through 12 programs that are targeted for students in poor school districts or students with disabilities.
Right.
Those programs sort of actually came before the Department of Education. So they, you know, didn't come about with the creation of the Department of Education, but they provide a great deal of funding for about $27 billion on elementary and secondary education, and then about $15 billion on special education to the states.
But why the necessity of the department, though? I mean, it seems to me that in some respect, and I was reading about it in preparation for this, that, you know, one of the primary motivations, they said, was to deal with, you know, whether or not school systems were appropriately implementing certain types of policies and whether or not, you know, the policy violated the Constitution or otherwise, whether they were unconstitutional, whether they were discriminatory in nature or otherwise. But the reality is a Department of Justice is the agency that actually conducts and manages those investigations and decides one way or another whether or not they're going to go after a state school system or a local school system. And why not just move to a block grant situation with states and let the states decide the best way to spend all of these dollars when you go through a lot of what they provide for and just remove and get this bureaucracy kind of off the federal budget?
Well, I think the rationale for a department is that these programs could be administered by different different departments, like I said, the Department of Justice, or, you know, the, it used to be called the Housing and Urban Development. You know, there are various other agencies that could run these programs. The problem with that is that you're going to actually duplicate some funding and expertise and some resources. And so centralizing the programs into a single department actually probably saves money in terms of the administration of these programs. And so that was sort of the part of the essence of creating the department, is that over the course of 20 or 30 years, the federal government had created these various education-related programs, you know, not just K through 12, but higher ed and some other programs as well, and that they were being administered in other agencies. But because they weren't centralized, they were, you know, duplicative in some ways, and that this actually streamlines and saves the government money. Now, it's a slightly different question about sort of a block grant and putting, you know, giving the states that flexibility. If you're talking about K through 12 education, the amount of money and the percentage of sort of overall funding for K through 12 education, the amount from the federal government is very, very small. And so about 10% of K through 12 funding is from the federal government. So already, states and local school districts are managing about 90% of the funding for K through 12 schools. So, you know, that's kind of already happening in terms of sort of who's in control and who can decide sort of whether to spend more money on teachers or more money on, you know, books or whatever that might be. But that's not a federal government decision to make under our current policy, or ever, really. So, you know, we do a lot of things through block grants, but this is already a program where the vast majority of this is already funded at the local level, and decisions are made by those at the state and local level about how that funding is allocated.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
For the past three seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a fourth season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
But there is this kind of phenomenon, right, with new administrations coming in and having these ideological conditions that are placed on a lot of this money, and, you know, trying to influence some change here, there, otherwise. We have a lot of friction between states and the federal government as to how best to spend these dollars in the present landscape. When we look at the amount of money that we spend in this country for education, I think we're the second highest in the world. Our outcomes are in the bottom third, and we're actually in the bottom of that bottom third. And, you know, we begin to wonder about whether or not it's time for us to kind of reimagine, re-engineer how we're going about doing that. I mean, and, you know, and I think one of the key examples, it was just reported on this morning. You have Democratic Senator John Tester up in Montana complaining about the Federal Department of Education with this one-size-fits-all policy that they're trying to implement relative to DEI goals, and whether or not that they were given the opportunity to make their case. and complaining about prioritizing diversity over merit. And it seems like we're getting caught up in this morass of these ideological wars, and meanwhile, our outcomes are abysmal.
Well, you're right in terms of the test score outcome data that, you know, the United States is not near the top in, you know, of a variety of different tests. In terms of kind of transitioning to a different way of doing education, if we were to do that, it would actually be, you know, a different way of doing things would be to give the federal government more authority, because the federal government has not historically had much to do at all with K through 12 education. So in terms of these mandates and kind of these culture war kind of issues around DEI or, book banning and these sorts of things, again, most of these kinds of policies are passed at the state and local level. To the extent that the Federal Department of Education gets involved, there is a small office of civil rights within the Department of Education. And, you know, the need for that comes out of sort of a history of K through 12 education in the United States in terms of states denying funds to school districts that were predominantly Black, and, you know, other historical discrimination of various groups, and the federal government kind of taking that authority to ensure equality of opportunity. I mean, that's where these programs that come out of the Department of Education come from, is this American desire for and support for equality of opportunity. You know, we have a strong belief that we can tolerate differences in income, even large differences in income, very, very rich and very, very poor in terms of outcomes, if we fundamentally have a society where everybody kind of has an equal shot at success. Because then if we have equality of opportunity, then any differences are due to effort or hard work or good ideas or whatever it might be, and not sort of systemic discrimination. And these programs that were put in place to help fund poor school districts and students with disabilities, that's the impetus for those programs. And to administer them federally is to ensure that states and localities, which have historically done a lot of the discriminating, aren't in a position to be able to do that, so that students, that we get closer to a situation where we have equality of opportunity. I think most anybody that works in education in any capacity understands that those funds don't create equality of opportunity, but it's certainly worse without them. And don't necessarily trust states and localities to administer them fairly and without bias, given the track record historically of states and localities on these issues.
I mean, I don't disagree with you because of the amount of lawsuits that are filed and that are challenged as it relates to, you know, in the aftermath of the affirmative action ruling. And, you know, when we talk about the opportunity, that's one thing, but when we're talking about equity, that's a new frontier that's entirely different. And we're tying a lot of these dollars now from federal DOE to this equity notion, which is run violative of the U.S. Constitution in so many different ways that are being challenged in these cases. And a lot of universities, high schools, and others throughout the country are having to reverse course on a lot of the programs and policies that they're implementing because, you know, and interestingly, a lot of it started with these conditions that were tied to a lot of this money that the Fed was giving out. And we're seeing the same thing with student debt relief today, you know, and we're doing a piecemeal approach to this because those students that are going to Tulane, UNO, Delgado, wherever it may be, and borrowing money today, there's no relief even talking about being handled for them. And in fact, almost every OIG report ever issued on the number one program of federal DOE, the FAFSA, has been negative. In fact, the most recent report was damning as it relates to their transition to the new application process.
Last year was an absolute disaster.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hadn't talked to a single university official that thought any of that went well. And that's the largest program that they manage. But it seems as though they're off on the sidelines, you know, running amok with a whole bunch. And this is both Republicans and Democrats. No one has the corner on this debacle, in my mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it seems like we're on the sidelines running amok with all of this, all of these other issues and not fulfilling the needs of their basic mission and vision of the organization. And any review that's done of this organization, I don't know if I hadn't found a real positive one yet. Maybe you have. I haven't.
Well, I think when you're talking about an organization as large as any of these federal agencies, you know, there's you'd have to talk about specific programs. And so when you talk about the FAFSA, you know, last year they rolled out a new application for federal student aid, and it was delayed and it had lots of glitches. And like you said, there's nobody out there that thinks that that went very well. Now, that program is completely separate from the programs that I'm talking about with regard to K-12 education.
Sure.
And neither of those, so the programs that I'm talking about with regard to Title I funding and IDEA funding, that's for disabled students, and FAFSA, none of that is tied to what you were talking about with regard to DEI. And I think that when Trump is talking about eliminating the Department of Education, you know, first, he's not the first Republican candidate to say that he's going to do this. Right? I think Reagan said that he was going to do this like a year or two after the department was created. And, you know, here we are. So, but I think the differences are now I think what Trump is talking about is these culture war issues, that this is a sort of symbolic issue that it's not necessarily, I don't hear from him that it is targeting government waste. You know, that is a common Republican belief that, you know, the federal government wastes a lot of money. We need to cut the size of the federal government in order to save money, right? But mostly when Trump is talking about this, it's around these kind of culture war issues. And so it's kind of a signal to his supporters of sort of where he stands on these issues, which I don't think anybody, you know, questions where he stands on those issues. But
that's, you know, not really the issue, is it? I mean, it's really the legitimacy of the whim of who we elect as president as to whether or not we're going to have a consistent way and fashion to educate our kids. And when we start tying some of these ideological notions to money, And it all depends on who's, you know, elected to the executive branch of government, I think it has a very disruptive force as to, you know, establishing some consistency. I mean, government moves slow. It's not very nimble. And if we have administration changes on 4-year cycles as opposed to 8-year cycles, it even gets more disruptive in what we're doing. And then when you add to it the toxicity that's out there today, we're seeing a disruption that we've never, ever seen before. Who's to blame is of no moment to me. It just seems like that fundamentally, structurally, something's got to change, because we cannot have these whims driving our educational policy in this country, because I don't think we're going to end up in a good place. I think we're going to end up worse off than we are now. Your thoughts?
Well, I wonder, I'd ask you a question about the issue of consistency. So do you think that schools across the United States should have a more consistent curriculum so that, you know, kids in Louisiana are, you know, they have a similar curriculum as kids, and you mentioned Montana or Ohio or wherever?
I think when it comes to the basics, there ought to be certain things that are kind of sacrosanct, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, in our approach. I'm one that kind of believes in a lot of the Montessori model that, you know, we're doing things where we're not spending as much time having kids read and bringing them up to their grade level early on in their education. You know, because the data is so overwhelming as to the success of that. So I do believe that there should be some standardization. But as we move through and we get to high school and stuff like that, I think we should leave that more to the states than the federal government. I understand what you're saying about the amount of money, but they carry a big stick in more ways than one. And, you know, and I've seen this happen with FERPA and so many other things that just don't make sense, that stand in the way of local government and state government trying to address situations not only on school campuses, but school policy and curriculum and moving forward.
Yeah, I guess the reason that I asked was that, you know, if we're, 'cause I think a lot of people agree with you that having more consistency around particularly early childhood and, you know, early secondary education is a good thing so that we don't have big differences across the states. But then who would administer that and who would ensure that that's going to be in place? It can't be the individual states. Right, if we're going to have consistency. And so there's a tension there, right? There's a desire for local control and, you know, getting the federal government out of our education, but also wanting to have, you know, strict accountability where students are testing and we're holding schools accountable and a consistent curriculum across all the states. And so, you know, if we're going to have those things, accountability and consistency, then, you know, there's going to need to be some kind of, that's the sort of purpose of the federal government. And so there's going to have to be some sort of federal authority.
I guess a hybrid model, right? Because there are basically 10 subcomponent agencies of the Department of Education. And the vast majority of it, I mean, you know this as well as I, that FAFSA and that taking up about 2/3 of the amount of funding that's out there from federal DOE, they outsource that. So they're not even managing it. You know, so
yeah, I mean, we have that, you know, I think we have that hybrid model right now where, you know, the vast majority of education spending is local and state, and the federal government has this sort of very small set of, you know, the small scope of authority and a pretty small budget.
But we get back to the whim of the politicization of, you know, we're going to give student debt relief. Oh, really? For who?
Mm-hmm.
A small segment of those that have incurred debt, and we're not modifying anything as it relates to the program moving forward, because that's going to be up to another administration,
I think President Biden would agree with you there, and the issue, and Trump wins the election and wants to eliminate the Department of Education, he will need Congress to be able to do that.
Sure.
And you
sure.
know, if President Biden could, you know, and he tried to do more with executive action in terms of student loan relief and doing things, but presidents don't have all the authority, right? And that's
right.
That's our system. And so Congress would have to pass some changes to our current laws around student loans and how they're administered and who's eligible and relief and all of those things. So that's not within the scope of authority for the president, as is neither the elimination of the department. All of that would have to come out of Congress.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I actually don't believe it's achievable, but I like to talk about it for folks to think about what's being said and how this is being handled and what the outcomes are, you know, the upsides and the downsides to this. In the end, I think you would agree our outcomes need to be improved. And I just don't see anybody really meaningfully moving this thing in the right direction for us at the present time. Thank you so much for joining us,
Jay
Celeste Lay, Professor, Department of Political Science at Tulane University. Really enjoyed the conversation. Have a great week.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.